Today is Friday, September the 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. The U.S. has formed a new Indo-Pacific alliance with Britain and Australia for sharing military and cyber technology.
The future of the Indo-Pacific will impact all our futures. To make these challenges, to help deliver the security and stability our region needs, we must now take our partnership to a new level.
A UN report on Venezuela finds that judges and prosecutors in the country are under intense political pressure from high-ranking officials to punish perceived opponents of the government of President Nicolas Maduro.
The mission has reasonable grounds to believe that instead of providing protection to victims of human rights violations and crimes, the Venezuelan justice system has played a significant role in the state's repression of governmental opponents.
And as Lebanon struggles with acute fuel and electricity shortages, Iran-backed Hezbollah has arranged for oil tankers carrying Iranian diesel fuel to arrive from Syria. That is, despite the threat of U.S. sanctions. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top stories, China has denounced a new Indo-Pacific security alliance between the United States, Britain, and Australia, warning that the partnerships would intensify the arms race in the region. The new alliance, dubbed AUKUS, will provide Australia with the technology and capability to deploy nuclear-powered submarines. President Biden made the announcement alongside British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, who joined him by phone to unveil the news.
Because we all recognize the imperative of ensuring peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific over the long term. AUKUS will bring together our sailors, our scientists, and our industries to maintain and expand our edge in military capabilities and critical technologies such as cyber, artificial intelligence, quantum technologies, and undersea domains.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison says that the alliance will provide security for the region.
The future of the Indo-Pacific will impact all our futures. To make these challenges, to help deliver the security and stability our region needs, we must now take our partnership to a new level.
That was Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison. And analysts said that China is likely to see the new alliance as a threat and an effort to limit its influence in the Indo-Pacific region. From Sydney, Phil Masser reports.
British officials have stressed that the pact wasn't a response to one country, but analysts believe it's an unmistakable sign of concern about China's military ambitions in the Indo-Pacific region. They've said it's highlighted the strategic importance of the region to both the United States and Britain. The new pact was announced Wednesday during a virtual joint state President Joe Biden made, along with Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. President Biden praised the partnership.
We need to be able to address both the current strategic environment in the region and how it may evolve, because the future of each of our nations, and indeed the world, depends on a free and open Indo-Pacific enduring and flourishing in the decades ahead.
In the joint statement, the leaders said there were several potential issues of concern, including territorial disputes, terrorism, and organized crime. Analysts said the deal was significant because it allows Australia to build nuclear-powered submarines for the first time. The government in Canberra has insisted the submarines would not carry nuclear weapons. The alliance, known by its acronym AUKUS, will also cover artificial intelligence, quantum technologies, and cyber defences. Johnson said the three nations were natural allies. Morrison said the pact would boost regional security.
The future of the Indo-Pacific will impact all our futures. To make these challenges, to help deliver the security and stability our region needs, we must now take our partnership to a new level. A partnership that seeks to engage, not to exclude, to contribute, not take, and to enable and empower, not to control or coerce. And so, friends, AUKUS is born.
However, Australia's news reports suggest the scrapping of a multi-billion-dollar submarine defence deal with France will cause immense diplomatic tensions between the two nations. The deal, the Australian government says, will be scrapped because of Australia's plans to build nuclear-powered submarines under the AUKUS security pact with the US and Britain. For decades, Australia has sought security with defence and intelligence pacts. The ANZUS, another security treaty between the US, Australia and New Zealand, recently celebrated its 70th anniversary. Australia is also an active member of the Five Eyes Alliance, which includes the US, Britain, Canada and New Zealand. The Five Eyes Alliance was created to monitor the Soviet Union after the Second World War. Australian officials have said the nuclear-powered submarines would be in service in the mid to late 2030s. Adam Bandt, leader of the Greens, a minor left-of-centre party, said on Twitter that the move was dangerous and would put floating Chernobyls in the heart of Australia's cities, referring to a nuclear energy accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Ukraine in 1986. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney. Voice of
America. A rise in COVID-19 infections may be affecting the job market in the U.S. Associated Press Washington correspondent Saga Meghani reports.
The number of Americans seeking jobless benefits rose last week by 20,000 after hitting a pandemic low the week prior. It's a sign more infections may be leading to more layoffs. The Delta variant spread has slowed the economy in recent weeks, with many Americans holding off on travel, hotel stays, and eating out. Jobless claims have been falling steadily for 2 months, coinciding with the scaling back of jobless aid for millions of people. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
The U.S. is working on new COVID-19 rules for international visitors. AP correspondent Mike Garcia has more.
New vaccine requirements for incoming international travelers are under consideration by the Biden administration as it looks to revamp current COVID-19 restrictions. Contact tracing of international travelers would be a part of the new system. White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator Jeffrey Zients said Wednesday, with the recent increase in COVID-19 cases, the current travel restrictions will remain in place until a new system is rolled out. The U.S. currently bars entry to most non-Americans who have traveled to China, India, the United Kingdom, and most of Europe, Brazil, and other countries in the previous 14 days. Mike Gracia, Washington.
And with the Afghan government severed from the international banking system, aid groups both inside Afghanistan and abroad say that they are struggling to get emergency relief, basic services, and funds to a population at risk of starvation. AP correspondent Charles De Ledesma has more.
Among the groups struggling to function is a public health non-profit that paid salaries and purchased food and fuel for hospitals. The $600 million in funds, which had been funneled through the Afghan Health Ministry, had dried up overnight after the Taliban took over the capital. Donor countries have pledged to open their purse strings to the tune of $1.2 billion in humanitarian aid. But attempts by Western governments and international finance institutions to deprive the Taliban-controlled government of other funding sources until its intentions are clearer has Afghans' most vulnerable citizens hurting. I'm Charles De Ledesma.
And with the U.S. out of Afghanistan after 20 years, some experts say that China and Pakistan are stepping in to provide both immediate support and the prospect of long-term investment for the Taliban government in Kabul. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports on what this could mean for the region and for the U.S. security interests.
Some Afghans are selling their prized possessions to finance their escape from Taliban rule or just to pay for food. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says the country is facing a humanitarian crisis. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Humanitarian aid will not solve the problem if the economy of Afghanistan collapses. And we know that the risk is enormous and that there is a dramatic lack of cash.
On Monday, the international community pledged more than $1.2 billion for humanitarian and development assistance for Afghanistan. The Taliban's acting foreign minister also called for access to the country's $10 billion in foreign assets, much of which has been frozen in the United States. Amir Khan Muttaqi is the Taliban acting foreign minister.
We believe that the USA is a big country. They need to have a big heart. Afghanistan is a poor country and must not be treated cruelly. We want positive and inclusive relations with the international community, and we ask them also to stop putting more pressure on the Afghan people.
The U.S. and other Western countries are calling on the Taliban to respect human rights, and in particular, the rights of women and girls, before the assets are released. But China and Pakistan have sent food and health supplies to the Taliban acting government and held meetings with Taliban representatives. Experts say for Pakistan, the support for the Taliban is nothing new. Maximilian Hess is with the Foreign Policy Research Institute.
Pakistan certainly has had a relationship with the Taliban or individuals who constitute some of the Taliban leadership going back over 30 years.
The U.S. State Department is calling on Pakistan to hold the Taliban accountable, as Islamabad had pledged to do. State Department spokesperson Ned Price.
We are going to continue to look to Pakistan and to other countries in the region to make good on their public statements, on commitments they have made to, in different ways, step up to support the people of Afghanistan.
Another analyst points out that for Pakistan, India is always a factor in the equation. Manjari Chatterjee Miller is with the Council on Foreign Relations.
Pakistan is worried about India. India is its number one enemy. And so it definitely wants a government in Afghanistan that is friendly towards Pakistan and not towards India.
As for China, one expert says the important thing to keep an eye on is long-term investment in Afghanistan. Here again, Maximilian Hess of the Foreign Policy Research Institute.
With regards to China, it's the potential for investment over the long term following the template that it has used on its Belt and Road program in Central Asia. This would typically begin with grants for large-scale road and infrastructure construction. Those have not been announced yet.
Another expert points out that investing in Afghanistan is a risky proposition. Again, Manjari Chatterjee Miller of the Council on Foreign Relations.
China is being very careful about how it supports Afghanistan and essentially doesn't want to be sinking money into a black hole with no guarantees of either, government survival or any guarantees of, the jihadi groups that China is worried about that the Taliban supports.
Qatar is also providing tons of medical and food aid to Afghanistan and is working to get the Kabul airport back up and running. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. As the U.S. Capitol Police prepare for Saturday's demonstrations on Capitol Hill, cybersecurity experts are pointing to the role of social media in mobilizing the right-wing crowd that will be protesting the ongoing criminal cases tied to individuals charged after the January 6th deadly riots. In fact, a new report finds that social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter are major drivers of the partisan political polarization in the U.S. today. Published by the New York University Stern Center for Business and Human Rights, the report titled Fueling the Fire, How Social Media Intensifies U.S. Political Polarization and What Can Be Done About It, says that even though some of the political and social divisions in this country predate social media, the platforms continue to play a major role in intensifying the polarization and that it could lead to real-world extremist violence like the January 6th insurrection. In this first part of our two-part conversation, Professor Paul Barrett, the Deputy Director of the NYU Stern Center for Business and Human Rights and also co-author of the report, tells me that one of the recommendations in the report is that Congress should intervene by providing federal funding for alternative social media platforms.
Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, they all have automated systems, algorithms, that are designed to serve up content that will promote engagement. Unfortunately, as we've learned over the years, the type of content that is most certain to provoke reactions from people, engagement, tends to be sensationalistic, incendiary, people shouting at each other, people calling each other not just wrong on the issues, but evil. And so all of that tends to promote political polarization or divisiveness, you can call it. And this has become a very acute problem.
So what are the consequences of this polarization?
The consequences of polarization are quite dire when it gets to the extreme level that we have right now. You end up with an erosion of trust, both in your fellow citizens and in political leaders and political institutions. You end up with an inability to agree on the most basic facts. For example, is it useful in the midst of a lethal pandemic to wear a mask? Is it a good idea to get a vaccination? Those are not actually ideological questions or debatable questions. Either you believe the doctors and the scientists or you don't believe them. And when you end up with a population, you end up with a population that is divided over those kinds of basic questions, you end up with problems. And finally, you end up with potential for political violence, which we saw on January 6th at the Capitol, because you end up with portions of the population who are so alienated and so misled by their leaders into thinking that evil forces are influencing the country, that they do something like take over the main symbol of democracy.
Weaponizing
and threaten and threaten the lives of the leaders. They want to hang the vice president, etc.
You know, how much of what we see on social media is actually representative of I guess popular sentiment of the majority of the people that are offline? If most of these ideas are distilled in this echo chamber that is either Twitter or Facebook, how much does that affect the millions that are offline or online but are not on these platforms?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting question. I suppose your implication is correct that if you're not seeing problematic, harmful content, you may not be affected by it in a direct way. It may not change your mind. But the problem is that the main platforms are now so large in terms of the amount of people who are on the platforms that there will be an effect, not just directly on those people, but on them stepping away from their computer and then going and doing things in the offline world. You know, the humorous aspect of this that people always refer to is your crazy uncle who's read something on the internet, comes to Thanksgiving and is spouting off all kinds of ideas and everyone's looking at each other and they don't know what to say to him. Okay, that's not very harmful, although it may be awkward. But if we have lots and lots of crazy uncles, we're getting lots of very divisive, incendiary ideas. Eventually, they become a problem for the rest of us, even if we're not as fixated on those ideas. You don't have to have the whole country taking over the Capitol building, but if you have a few thousand people, that can create quite a threat.
That was Professor Paul Barrett, the Deputy Director of NYU Stern Center for Business and Human Rights. He was one of the co-authors of this report. Second part of our conversation next week. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. And in more headline news, the French government says that its forces have killed the leader of the Islamic State in the Great Sahara in a drone strike. Adnan Abu Walid al-Sarawi was hit while riding on a motorbike carrying two people during a French-led air and ground operation in Mali. And Russian President Vladimir Putin says several people from his inner circle had contracted coronavirus, a reason why he couldn't personally attend a summit of the Collective Security Treaty Organization in the capital of Tajikistan. Mr. Putin says that he was unable to attend in person because he is in quarantine. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. UN investigators report that judges and prosecutors in Venezuela are under intense political pressure from high-ranking officials to punish perceived opponents of the government of President Nicolas Maduro. The UN Independent International Fact-Finding Mission on Venezuela will present its findings and recommendations to the UN Human Rights Council next week. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The three-member mission accuses the Maduro government of a pattern of serious human rights violations and crimes under international law in the context of its policy to silence and quash the opposition. It says the judiciary's independence has been eroded because of intimidation and threats against judges and prosecutors to do the state's bidding. The mission was denied entry into Venezuela to conduct its probe. Its findings are based on 177 interviews and extensive analysis of thousands of pages of legal case files and other official documents. Additionally, chair of the mission, Marta Valinas, says a detailed analysis of 183 detentions of real or perceived government oppositions presents a full picture of irregularities marring all stages of the criminal process.
Based on the investigations and analysis conducted, the mission has reasonable grounds to believe that instead of providing protection to victims of human rights violations and crimes, the Venezuelan justice system has played a significant role in the state's repression of government opponents.
The report notes most justices are appointed provisionally, and this makes them vulnerable to how they carry out their functions. It says several former judges and prosecutors and family members who had been subjected to threats have fled the country out of security concerns. Mission member Francisco Cox Vial says judges order pretrial detention as a routine rather than an exceptional measure. He says the mission reviewed 183 cases of detention. He says 113 of the detainees made allegations of having been tortured, sexually assaulted, and/or subjected to other cruel treatment.
In 67 of these, the detainees appeared in court with clear marks of mistreatment or raised allegations of torture, sexual violence, and or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment during court proceedings. The mission is also concerned that many of the detainees were handed back to the custody of agency who allegedly had tortured them.
In contrast to the treatment of government opponents, the report notes that in recent years, public officials in Venezuela, including some at a high level, have been able to commit violations and crimes with impunity. The mission says the Venezuelan state is constitutionally obligated to investigate and punish all perpetrators of human rights violations, regardless of their position. Mission members say they have repeatedly tried to contact the government and justice authorities to discuss its findings, but to no avail. They say the government, regrettably, has not responded to any of their letters. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Science in a Minute.
An international team of astronomers with the Molecules with ALMA at Planet-Forming Scales, or MAPS program, have identified what they call significantly large pools of organic molecules within planet-forming disks surrounding young stars. The molecules were found as the astronomers made detailed maps of the chemicals inside of the disks. The team refers to the molecules as precursors necessary for forming the basis of life. Karen Oberg from the Harvard and Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, who led the map-making project, says that some of the identified molecules are linked with the origins of life right here on Earth. ALMA is the Atacama Large Millimeter Array Radio Telescope located in Chile. A series of 20 papers outlining the team's findings will be published in the Astrophysical Journal Supplement. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. As Lebanon struggles with acute fuel and electricity shortages, Iran-backed Hezbollah has arranged for oil tankers carrying Iranian diesel fuel to arrive in the country from Syria. That is despite the threat of U.S. sanctions. For VOA, Del Gavlak reports from Amman in Jordan.
Lebanese news reports say Hezbollah has started bringing Iranian fuel into Lebanon, with about 20 tankers entering the northern Bekaa Valley early Thursday after shipping it into neighboring Syria. Beirut's Anahar newspaper said that some residents in the town of Shawakar fired shots in the air to celebrate the entry of the Iranian diesel. Hezbollah announced that as many as four such shipments of fuel from Iran are expected. Observers say the Iranian fuel could help ease Lebanon's crippling energy shortages, but critics argue that accepting it will expose the country to the risk of U.S. sanctions and comes with conditions attached. Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University tells VOA that Hezbollah is choosing to disregard the threat of sanctions because the group's leaders see it as a win-win situation for themselves.
Ordinary people are literally dying because they are lacking all the basic necessities, fuel, electricity, gasoline, water even, internet. To these people, any slight improvement will be seen as something fantastic. So Hezbollah can cash in on that. Even if Lebanon is slapped with sanctions, for Hezbollah, Lebanon will have been wrenched away from its Western and Arab ties, its traditional orientations, and taken towards Syria, Iran, maybe even eventually China. They have been hell-bent on hijacking Lebanon out of its traditional connections with the West and with the Arab world and into something completely new.
Observers say the arrival of the fuel could mark a new phase in Lebanon's two-year financial crisis, one of the worst economic meltdowns in the country's history. With the central bank unable to release dollars to pay for fuel imports, many Lebanese suffer from chronic power cuts for as many as 22 hours a day. Robert G. Rabil, a professor of political science at Florida Atlantic University, writing in the magazine National Interest, urges Washington to recognize the urgency of helping Lebanese now and work with civil society organizations to help change the socio-political conditions that allowed Hezbollah and other non-state actors to thrive in the first place. Habib Malik warns that Western help with energy is desperately needed right now. He says a U.S. plan for supplying electricity to Lebanon has been too slow.
This is something that makes a lot of sense over months and maybe even years, but it doesn't in any way address people's immediate needs. The U.S. seems to be operating on a completely unrealistic timescale.
Energy expert Diana Qaisi, an advisor to the Independent Lebanese Oil and Gas Initiative in Beirut, told the Saudi Arab News that Hezbollah does not have a permit from the energy ministry and that, she says, suggests the diesel will be sold below market price. This means that there will be a competitor in the fuel market and therefore a new cartel will emerge, owning illegal weapons and selling fuel based on incorrect foundations, Qaisi says of Hezbollah's action. Iran and Hezbollah are already the target of U.S. sanctions. Former U.S. President Donald Trump reimposed sanctions on Iran in 2018 in a bid to cut its oil sales. While Hezbollah is designated by the U.S. and EU nations as a terrorist group. Dale Gaplek for VOA News. Aman Jordan.
The city of Paris is unveiling a monumental artwork built around an actual monument, the Arc de Triomphe, completely wrapped in silver and blue fabric. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has more.
The 1961 installation by late artist couple Christo and Jean-Claude will open on Saturday, with visits taking place for almost 3 weeks. Visitors will not only be able to see the gleaming fabric when they go, but to touch it too, as the artist had intended. That's assuming they climb the 164 feet to the top. They'll step on it as they reach the roof terrace. At the press conference on the project, France's culture minister, Roselyne Bachelot, called it a formidable gift offered to Parisians, the French and beyond, to all art lovers. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day, at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Funganyi in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great weekend.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands with soap and water or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa Center for Disease Control. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.